And we're talking this morning about what I think is one of the most important issues in biblical counseling, and that is balancing sin and suffering in counseling issues. This is a really important topic for us to talk about in biblical counseling because of a couple of different contexts for the conversation. So it's important to talk about sin and suffering because, as people who believe in the Bible, we are the only people who see sin in counseling. So think about that. Secular counseling, secular therapy, does not see sin. They don't see it. They see pain, they see weakness, they don't see fallenness. Nobody's perfect. Everybody's got trouble, but they don't see moral culpability. They don't see anything that is blameworthy. That is to say, they don't see the main thing that is wrong with the human race. Which means, you have to say, they are completely irrelevant when it comes to helping people with their problems. And that's an understatement. It's not like I overdid it. If you don't see the main problem that creates difficulty in our world, then you are the other side of worthless when it comes to helping people with their problems. One of the things that amazes me is that biblical counselors are sometimes on the defensive on the issue of, is the Bible sufficient for counseling? Well, clearly the Bible's not sufficient for counseling. I find that an absurd argument. What I find to be insufficient for counseling is secular psychology. Secular therapy is insufficient for counseling when they don't see the main problem. So it's important for us to talk about sin and suffering because the context of counseling in 21st century Western thought does not see sin unless you're committed to the Bible. But here's the other thing. Christians, namely biblical counselors, have been fussy about this issue for about the last 40 years. So if you divide the biblical counseling movement into two 20-year periods, the first 20 years was biblical counselors emphasizing sin in the counseling process. And they emphasized that because secular therapy in the middle of the last century was defined exclusively by its secularity, and there wasn't an understanding of sinfulness in the counseling room. And so they wanted to recover this most important issue that had been lost. But after about 20 years, at the end of the 1980s, at the beginning of the 1990s, there started to be a concern that, well, hey, we need to talk about sin, but we also need to talk about suffering. And then that started about a 10 or a 15-year deal where it was all suffering all the time, and people sort of lost track of sinfulness. And even some biblical counselors have grown to be nervous about talking about sin because it seems harsh and abrasive. And I think where we are now, if we're in a third generation of the biblical counseling movement, first generation focuses on sin, second generation focuses on suffering. I think we're in a third generation now that is starting to recover some balance, that we need to talk about both of these things. The biblical teaching on suffering is just as profound as the biblical teaching on sin. And we need to talk about both of them. We need to talk about both of them because counseling is a complex activity. It's not simple. It's not as though people are always coming to counseling merely because of their sin, or people are always coming to counseling merely because of their suffering. In fact, as I describe in your notes here, I think we can talk about four contexts for sin and suffering in counseling, which requires more careful thought than let's just pay attention to sin or let's just pay attention to suffering. One context for this is counselees who sin apart from a context of suffering. So these are the high-handed sinners. Nothing's wrong. Nobody did anything to them. They're not particularly experiencing any kind of weakness, but they just sin because they want to sin. This is St. Augustine in the Confessions, if you've read the Confessions, when he is stealing pears from the garden of the neighbor, I believe. And he realized he was a sinner because he stole the pears. And not just that he stole the pears. He realized it's not that I stole the pears because somebody I knew needed pears. He said, it's not like I stole the pears because I was starving to death and I needed something to eat. He said, I stole the pears because I liked stealing. That's a high-handed sin. No suffering, you just want to do it, so you do it. People get hurt. Then, another context is counselees who suffer as a result of their sin. This is the context where you sin, you think it's going to be great, you think it's going to be wonderful, but now the sin does what sin does, and it bites back hard. You thought it was going to be great, and now it hurts. It's going to be a blast to look at porn. But now your mom found out. She's freaked out. It's going to be a blast to have sex with your boyfriend. But now you're pregnant. And you don't know what to do. It's going to be great to take a little extra money out of the petty cash drawer at work, but now you're fired. This is, you sinned, and now the fruit of the sin is bringing about suffering in your life. The third context is counselees who suffer apart from a context of their sin. So this is on the other side of the continuum. Here, you have real pain and real brokenness that is owing to no moral culpability on your part. This happens and is able to happen because we live in a world full of sinners. So Romans 3:23 says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That means two things, not just one. When you read Romans 3:23, it means in the first instance that you, the reader, are a sinner. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God means as I read this, I am one of the people indicted by the verse. But it also means a second thing, and it means that everybody I ever know or everybody I ever encounter is also sinful. So this says something about you, and it says something about the people you live with. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And so, you don't have to do anything wrong to get burned by the sin of a human being, because you live next door to sinners, you have sinners growing up in your house, you have sinners setting your curfew, you go to bed at night with a sinner. Everybody you encounter is a sinner, and those sinners can hurt you even when you do nothing wrong. This is also possible because we live in a fallen world. We live in a world where Adam thrust us into a world of guilt, and now there are cancer diagnoses and tornadoes and drowning deaths, and nobody did anything wrong in the immediate context, but we live in a world that experiences the sting of sin. And so we have to be honest that when you understand the way this works biblically, you can be in great pain and in great trouble for nothing that you did wrong, but because you live in a world full of other sinners and you live in a world that is tainted with sin. And then a fourth context for sin and suffering is counselees who sin as a result of their suffering. So here we'll take a blameless person who has been thrust into a difficult and a painful situation through perhaps no fault of their own, but their response to that blameless suffering is to engage in blameworthy responses. So this is the problem of Job's wife, right? You feel terribly for Job's wife. She's sitting there minding her own business with her husband, and the fields are destroyed, the animals are destroyed, and every child dies. I don't think any of us know what we would do on such a day. But she didn't do the right thing. She said, curse God and die. we understand that Job's wife was in great turmoil and pain. And yet, she responded to that turmoil and pain in a way that was sinful, and in a way that was not required by the suffering. Sometimes we say that our suffering is the excuse that allows a lot of different sinful responses. And we say it's more than an excuse, it actually mandates it. You know, what else can you do? But then we have her husband standing there right next to her who said, "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So suffering does not require a sinful response, but it often does take on a sinful response. And so these are the four contexts in counseling, it seems to me, of sin and suffering. And the extremes are relatively easy to deal with. If you flip over to 1 Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14. A passage in Scripture that if it were the only verse in the Bible, we would have more resources for counseling than the corpus of secular psychology. And I'm not kidding. It's so rich in counseling implications. Just one verse. "We urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all." The text says there are three kinds of counseling problems. There's three kinds of people that will show up for counseling. There are the idle. Some translations do little different things with this word, but it means sinful or disorderly or undisciplined. These are the sinners. Sinners, high-handed sinners, need to be admonished. You admonish the sinful. And then a second kind of person is the faint-hearted. These are the discouraged people. These are the sufferers. You encourage those people. Now think about how profound it is. You correct sinners and you encourage weak people. Do you know how much difficulty in ministry I would have seen avoided if people could just get those first two right? I was standing at a funeral. It's one of the first funerals that I presided over. I was in a very traditional church when I first started out in ministry. And by the time I'd been in ministry 4 years, I'd presided over 70 funerals. That's a lot of heartache. One of those funerals was a husband whose very young wife had died. She was in her 30s, kids in the home, and your wife's dead, and we're standing at the head of the casket as the people file by, and this man was crying, and somebody in our church said, You have to be more joyful than this. God is in control. This is not bad. You have to trust the Lord. I mean, this is happening right in front of the funeral, and the man's dead wife is laying right here. And what was that person's problem? The person's problem was 1 Thessalonians 5:14. You don't admonish the faint-hearted. You encourage the faint-hearted. They think they've got the sovereignty of God down pat. And they don't. It's a violation of Scripture to admonish the faint-hearted. But then we get it wrong the other way, too. We sometimes encourage the undisciplined. I've seen this. I mentioned some of this in my talk last night. I served underneath a pastor that... a woman was a serial adulteress against her husband, and she was talking about how he was not the most fun person to be with, and he was boring, and she wanted to go out and do stuff. And this pastor was encouraging her. Well, you know, that's, we understand, and it's hard, and, you know, trying to help her feel better about what she'd done. And you don't encourage the adulteress. You don't say, it's okay, you know, you do have it hard, that's a bad deal. You say, quit. Turn from your sin. Leave your life of sin and follow Christ. It's entry-level ministry. You do not encourage the unruly, and you do not admonish the faint-hearted. And then there's this third person, the weak person. This is talking about, I think, the person experiencing the difficulties of a fallen world. This is the person diagnosed with cancer. This is my wife when she was 9 months pregnant with our daughter, and I was switching jobs. I was moving from being a pastor to a professor at Southern Seminary. We were switching houses. We were moving from our one house to another house. We were in litigation because our house that we had owned had sunk 14 feet into the ground. So we were dealing with all that. I was in the PhD program and had comprehensive exams. And the way comprehensive exams work is your professors get to ask you anything they want. You have 4 hours to answer the question, and they don't tell you what they're going to ask. And if you fail one of the three, you fail all of them, and they thank you for participating in the program and send you on your way. And failure is anything less than a B. So B minus is a failing grade, and if you get a B minus on one, you're out of the program. So there's no margin for error here. And she was having trouble and was on bed rest. Okay, so all this is happening at once, and we're moving. And so we were just in boxes. You know, I'm trying to switch jobs. I'm trying to study for these exams. She's not allowed to do anything. She was unpacking boxes. And I was like, I don't think you're allowed to unpack boxes. You're on bed rest. And she's like, well, this isn't much. This is okay. And I was like, I think we need to talk to the OB. So we call and we say, you know, she's unpacking boxes and vacuuming. Like, what is bed rest? And she's like, bed rest is when you are in the bed, resting. And you get up to go to the bathroom, and then you go back to bed, and you rest some more. And my wife, who is Italian, said, well, I can't do that. I mean, I've got a son who needs to eat. We're moving. Like, I can't do that. And the OB, who is not Italian but didn't care, said, you have to do that. This is your baby in your body, and you have to do it. So we were tapped out. We had no resources, and we had about 10 people from our church descend on our house, and they brought my wife unsweet tea and put her feet under an ottoman, and they just unpacked boxes for a whole night and got our whole house unpacked for us. We were weak people. Nobody did anything wrong. But we were weak people, and they helped us. This is what you do. You help weak people. They don't need admonished. They don't just need encouragement. It's going to be okay. Well, yeah, I believe it's going to be okay, but we're also in boxes here, you know. We need some horsepower here to help us. And then this last encouragement, be patient with them all. We blow this one maybe more than the others, because there are people on this list that all of us could make an excuse that it's okay to be impatient with them. We think that when somebody's a sinner, when they're just a high-handed jerk, it's okay to be impatient with that person. It's okay to issue the admonishment in a frustrated way. And Paul says no. Even when you admonish a sinner, you have to be patient with them. You have to be gentle, sensitive, long-suffering. I once had a counseling student, a wonderful counselor, who she was a female, and she just was wired to just be happy. She was wired to, life's hard, but you plow through and get it done. And it frustrated the daylights out of her when she would talk to women who were sad. And she would get prickly in counseling. You know, because it's like, what? This is not even that big of a problem. I mean, she's saying to me, she wouldn't ever say that. She would never say that in counseling. But these people would leave the room, and she'd be like, oh my goodness, who are these women? This is not that big of a problem. And I'm like, okay. I won't use her real name. We'll say she's Sarah. Okay, Sarah. Hang on just a second. A problem is not judged to be a problem by your experience of the problem. A problem is judged to be a problem by the person's experience of the problem. And if they have a problem and are sad and you are frustrated with them, the problem is with you. Because the Bible says you have to be patient. And so the Lord is changing you in this just as much as he's changing the other person. You're not allowed to be impatient just because a person is discouraged about things that would not discourage you. And then weakness. This makes people impatient. I have my own life. I have my own problems. We got boxes in our house, honey. Why do we have to go over to the Lambert's house? Just because she's on bed rest, you know? Can he work a little harder? It's easy to get impatient with the weaknesses of other people. And Paul says, you're not allowed to do that. So this is just, I mean, good night. Honestly, it's not an exaggeration. In fact, when I teach methods of biblical counseling at Southern, it's an exposition of 1 Thessalonians 5:14 for a whole semester. We could spend months and do spend months talking about the implications of this for our counseling care. But the point is that high-handed sinners get a rebuke. This entry-level and advanced. You rebuke sinners, and innocent sufferers need encouragement. The complications is when these things start to get mixed up. When people aren't just one thing on the list, but they're two things on the list, or three things on the list. This is where things get dicey. And so what I want to talk about here for the rest of the time is ministry at the intersection of sin and suffering. What do we do with counselees experiencing suffering as a result of their sin? What do we do about that? Here's some examples. An unfaithful husband who must break off an adulterous relationship with a woman for whom he feels affection and who is sad over the pain he has caused others in his sinfulness. I've talked with numerous men like this. One of my very first counseling situations was this issue. I've been a pastor for not long, less than a year, and the married couple is sitting in my office, and as they sit there, he is actively engaging in adultery. He has an adulterous partner this relationship is ongoing. It's not like he broke up with her, he got found out, and it's over. It's ongoing, and they're in counseling, and they're sitting there. He knows it's going on, she knows it's going on, and he has communicated to her before they come in for counseling that he can't break up with her. So this is the situation as they sit in my office. I can't break up with her, he says. And he says, with his wife crying on the other side of the room, I love my wife. She's the mother of my kids. She's a great wife. I don't want to end my marriage, but I also love this other woman. And I can't break up with her. And she's crying, and he's crying. And now look, it's easy to imagine yourself stabbing that man to death. Okay? All right. I get it. I get it. But just think about it for a moment. Okay? Now, I want to argue that he actually is not altogether different from any of us in the room. Now, in God's kindness, I have never committed adultery. But I have more in common with that man than I would like to admit. And so do you. Because all of us know what it feels like to love something that God hates, and to hate something that God loves. And that's where that guy is. What do you do with him? He's legitimately sinning, but he is also in legitimate pain. He's torn. We might not be tempted to be sensitive to the man's suffering, but 1 Thessalonians corrects us. And we've got an unruly person who is faint-hearted. What do we do? How do we handle that? A student, another example, failing out of school because of irresponsible living. So, true story. Several years ago, I have a lot of students at at Southern and at their undergraduate school, Boys College, it's impossible for me to keep track of all the students that I have. I have graders who are monitoring the progress of the students. I'm not grading all the papers. I'm not grading all the exams. I don't know where, you know, I mean, I think this semester I think I have 900 students. So I'm not at all able to keep track of those things, but I have a grader for about every 100 students, and they're able to keep track of where students are and what work has come in and that kind of thing. And one of those students, and I actually can have a very close relationship with a student, but not know how they're doing in any one of my classes because I'm not able to monitor all that information. And there was one student that I knew fairly well. He was a member of the church that I pastored, and I knew he was engaged to be married to a young woman who was also a student of mine, and I knew them. They'd been in our home. What I did not know is that in one of his classes, he was a biblical counseling major at the college, and in one of his senior level classes that is required to graduate, he had not turned in an assignment for the whole semester. 25 assignments, he hadn't turned in one of them. You can't pass if you don't turn in a single assignment. Well, I didn't know. I'm not grading the stuff. I'm not checking it off the list. And I get a phone call from the provost, or the registrar, excuse me. And they say, hey, you have this student. He hasn't turned in, you know, he's got a failing grade for this class that's required to graduate, but he's on the graduation roster. Is he truly failing? And I said, well, I don't know. Let me check. So I get on the phone with the grader. He tells me, he hasn't turned in a single assignment. I have followed up with him. He was able to produce the emails. Hey, we don't have your work. There have been like 6 emails with no response from this student. He also hadn't been at a number of classes. And he's like, yeah, he's failing. And so I called the registrar back and I said, yep, he's failed the class. He can't graduate. That was the day before. It was 2 days before graduation, the day before graduation rehearsal. Well, this student is in line at graduation rehearsal, and the registrar is coming through and checking names off, and he's like, you're not graduating. And he said, yes, I am. And he said, no, you're not. He said, you failed one of your senior counseling classes. You have to have it to graduate. You can't graduate. Crosses his name off the list, pulls him out of line. So I knew that conversation happened because I was in my office working, and there's this like pounding on my door, and I open it up, and there he is. And he sat down, and he said, Dr. Lambert, you have to help me. He said, I have to graduate tomorrow. He said, my parents flew into town. This girl that I'm dating, her parents, or they're engaged now, they're going to get married, her parents came into town. My siblings, my aunts, my grandparents, they flew into town. My dad rented a facility tomorrow night for a graduation party. I have to graduate tomorrow. And I said, well, here's the problem. In order to graduate, there are things that you have to do. And one of those things is come to class, and another one of those things is do your work, and you didn't do those. And he began to sob and plead with me, you know, there's a dozen people in town, will you please help me? Is there something you can do? Now, it's the same situation as the married guy we talked about before. This guy's guilty. My mom would say he's as guilty as homemade sin. But he's also legitimately broken over the sin. We got an undisciplined person, an unruly person, and we have a faint-hearted person. What do we do? What's counseling wisdom there? And then there's a counselee sinning in response to their suffering. This is a wife who refuses to forgive her husband for adultery. This is one of the most common counseling problems I encounter. You have a guy who has been sinful, but then he has repented of the sin. He wants to be restored in his marriage, and his wife is finding it very difficult to extend forgiveness. In fact, more than just not extending forgiveness, she wants to punish him. One couple that I knew, he had been unfaithful with her very best friend. And he confessed it. He turned from it. They were in counseling with me over it. And she wasn't pulling off the forgiveness thing. And one night, she was making breakfast for dinner. And she started thinking about how he cheated with her very best friend. And he came in from work, and he said, "Hey, honey." And when she saw him, she picked up the skillet, and she started hitting him in the head. He had cuts, burns all over his head because she was so furious and so had a lack of forgiveness for his sin that she went in on him with this frying pan, and he was in bad shape. We understand this woman's pain. We get it. I can't imagine that kind of pain. I think maybe there are a couple things that I would experience, I think, as some of the most heartbreaking realities in my life, and one of them is if my wife was unfaithful. I can't imagine what that kind of pain feels like. But we also have to say that by the time you are beating your husband with a hot frying pan, something in your response to that sin has gone deeply wrong. A widower who loses his job after failing to return to work in the months after his wife's death. This is another situation I knew about. I mentioned one man I knew whose young wife died. Another guy, middle-aged man, his wife died. He was working for another person in my church, and that person said, "You take the time that you need. We love you. We're going to figure it out. Come back when you're ready." And this man was in very great mourning. He couldn't get out of bed. He quit talking to his kids, quit answering the door, didn't go to work, and his employer was fine with him not coming to work for the first couple of weeks. He was fine with him not coming to work for the first couple months. But by the time it got to month 3 and month 4, he's coming to me and saying, "What do I do? I mean, we've got this. I mean, I want to be sensitive." And I told him, "Come when you're ready. But it's been 4 months. And this work is piling up. We got to do something." We understand the man's pain. And yet we have to say the response to the pain of cutting off your kids, of not coming to work, you seem to be grieving as one with no hope. And what are we going to do here? So these are the hard ones. Most counseling will require wisdom about how to engage counselees who are legitimate sufferers and guilty sinners. The methodological question, the process question, is when you've got a person who is unruly and you've got a person who is at the same time faint-hearted, which one do you deal with first? You want to do both. Please understand, we are not talking about picking which one we deal with. It's not like we're going to say if you've got a sinful person and a faint-hearted person in the same person that we're going to pick one and exclude the other. That's not the choice. We're going to obey the Bible, and we're going to admonish the unruly and encourage the faint-hearted, but what we need to do is figure out what in wisdom would be the best one to deal with first. And this is a wisdom question. It's a judgment call question. I want to be honest with you that there is nothing in the Bible that says here's the one you deal with first. But I think that there are biblical principles that inform our judgment. And I want to say that the general rule ought to be to engage suffering first and then engage sin. If you've got an undisciplined and a faint-hearted person in one individual, I think the better part of wisdom, as a general rule, is to deal with them on their suffering first. A couple reasons. First, it's Christ-like. Look at Matthew chapter 12. We'll start in verse 15. It's telling us the kind of Messiah that Jesus Christ came to be. Jesus aware of this, withdrew from there in verse 15 of chapter 12. And many followed him, and he healed them all, and ordered them not to make him known. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah, "Behold my servant, whom I have chosen, my beloved, with whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench, until he brings justice to victory." A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench. This is Jesus quoting Isaiah about what kind of redeemer he is. And Jesus endorses Isaiah's statement that the kind of Messiah Jesus is the kind of Messiah that is on the lookout for someone who's struggling. He's on the lookout for someone who is in pain. And Jesus wants to be very careful to do nothing to crush someone who is in pain. There's a longer way to see this, and that is by looking at the way Jesus rebukes sinful people as he encounters them in the Gospels. Jesus' rebuke of the Pharisees, high-handed sinners, knowledgeably religious people who have a cleaned-up life, his rebukes to them are scorching. "You brood of vipers." This is not, this doesn't make it into the children's books about Jesus, okay? I mean, if your pastor at your church said that, if he just, "You brood of vipers," you'd be like, "I'm going someplace else." We don't like that. That's strong talk. But that's how Jesus talks to high-handed sinners. That is not the way Jesus talks to broken sinners. It's not the way Jesus talks to the sinful woman caught in adultery. It's not the way Jesus talks to the woman at the well, a serial adulteress, a promiscuous woman. Jesus doesn't speak to her that way. He's on the lookout for hurting and struggling people, and he has a commitment that he won't quench a smoldering wick. He won't break a bruised reed. So we got to do what Jesus does and be on the lookout for people who are broken and in pain, and we'll be like that when we try to engage suffering before we engage sin. Secondly, it's loving. 1 Corinthians 13:7, fascinating passage. It says, "Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things." I want to focus on one of those, namely, love believes all things. It's loving to believe the best about people. I think an application of this to engaging suffering first is because it's fundamentally loving to look at someone and see the part of them that is legitimately wounded by legitimate pain. And it's fundamentally suspicious when, and so unloving, love believes all things, so an attitude of suspicion towards people is an unloving attitude. It's fundamentally suspicious of people to look at folks in their pain and start trying to find the places where they are responsible. Where is it your fault? Do you know a lot of times we do this? I hate to admit it, but a lot of times we look at people with trouble and our first moral instinct is to try to find something they did that made it happen. This is what the disciples did with Jesus. This guy on the street, blind. What in the world do they know? He's sitting there blind. And what do they say? They say, "Jesus, whose fault is it? Who sinned? Did this guy sin? Or did his parents sin?" They look at suffering and they try to identify blame. It's fundamentally suspicious. And what is fundamentally loving is to just see a hurting person and not have strings attached. Third, it's gentle. Look at Proverbs 15:1. says, very well-known passage, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The principle here is someone says or does something to you, and the purpose of the passage is to teach us how to undercut a wrathful response. We don't want in our encounters with people to get a wrathful response. We want to turn away the wrath. And so he says, give a soft answer. So then we have to ask, well, what's a soft answer? Does it mean that we speak in gentle tones? What is a soft answer? Honestly, the text doesn't tell us. It just says a soft answer. So what the text is doing here is inviting us to consider all of the ways that we could endorse a soft answer and avoid a harsh answer. And so we just have to start thinking about this. And there are all kinds of ways that we could give a soft answer. We could not yell and speak kindly. We could return service to somebody. I had one counselee come. He was in my office. He was dealing with an issue, and he started yelling at me. I hadn't even gotten started. He just started yelling at me. And I come in here, and all we do is talk, and nothing gets. And I said he was dealing with a particular problem at his house, and I said, you know what? I think I understand why you're upset. Let's go over to your house and let's fix this. So we went over to his house and we started dealing with a problem, not a counseling problem as it turned out, but his house was in a mess. And so I went over and helped him clean up his house. Listen, I'm telling you, that guy listened to everything I said. If I could have told him, you'll fix your problem if you chew through the drywall, and he'd have done it. And that was just one way to give a soft answer. I just said, let's go, let me come help you. And so we did. So the text is inviting us to consider all the ways we might be gentle. And one way that we can be gentle, one way among many, is we can encourage people in their suffering. It's humble. Galatians 6, 1-5. This is another one of those passages that... honestly, you could write a book on counseling that is nothing more than an exposition of Galatians 6, 1-5. You could have hundreds of pages just unpacking the implications of these verses for counseling. It says, brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. And then it goes on, but that's enough for us now. This is a passage that encourages humility in counseling. It says, if you see someone who's transgressing, you need to go and restore that person in a spirit of gentleness. But be careful. It is spiritually dangerous to restore a transgressor. It says, you have to keep watch on yourself lest you too be tempted. What he's saying is that there can be a sense of spiritual superiority when you think, I'm the spiritual person who's going to correct this transgressor, and it's easy to start believing, I don't struggle with these kinds of problems. This is some kind of weak person who's cut from different spiritual cloth than I am. And Paul says, Don't do it. You become very prone to the same sins of people you are correcting if you don't keep watch on yourself, because let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall, because pride goes before destruction. And so he says, one of the ways that he says to do that is bear one another's burdens. That's fascinating. We got a sinner here. You're supposed to go correct him, but be careful, because you'll get in a mess if you're not careful. And the very first thing he says after he says to be careful is bear one another's burdens. He says, try to find the burdens of people that you're going to help shoulder. That's one way to keep watch on yourself. Because think how logical it is. When you look at them with a suspicious attitude of judgment and start trying to assign blame first, you place yourself outside of the context of their pain. And what he says to do is he says, sign up to walk with them in their pain. Get down in the dirt with them. Shoulder some of their burdens. And that's going to be one way that you stay humble. So one way that we stay humble when we correct a transgressor is to look for areas of suffering that they're experiencing that we can help to shoulder. Does that make sense? Okay. It's slow. Next, it's slow. We'll go back to Proverbs here. We're skipping around. Proverbs 13. Proverbs 13, verse 3. Whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. And then James 1:19, you don't need to turn there, but it says, let every person be quick to hear and slow to speak. Which, just on James 1:19, we flip that. Oftentimes we start speaking when we didn't hear enough. And so what the principle of these passages, when you put them together, is speaking isn't necessarily the first thing you do, but is often the last thing you do. You don't just start yapping. You wait to hear. And one thing, there's all kinds of principles from that. We could talk about that if we had more time too. But one thing that we can learn from that is I need to be looking for all the things on the radar in this person's difficulty. And I need to be sure I understand all of their problems, not just their moral blameworthiness, before I start speaking. And then finally, it's strategic. Proverbs 25, verse 11. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. So there's two things here. There's the word, and there's the fitly spokenness of it. All right? And you can have the one without the other. The word is corresponding to the apples of gold, and the fitly spokenness of it is corresponding to the setting of silver. Sometimes we think that just because we know the right thing to say, that's what's important, and we don't have to figure out the right time to say it. But Proverbs warns us that if you have the word, the golden apples, without the right timing, without the setting of silver, you can just lob golden apples at people. And that's not going to help anybody. I had one time, Lauren and I don't even remember exactly what had happened, but there was some, it was this particular morning, I had done something that annoyed her. I don't remember what it was, and she said something to me, and I don't remember what she said, but she said something to me that I thought, whoa, that was sinful. But I was moving, I was running late, I was headed out the garage door, and I thought, well, we can just talk about it later. And that was a busy day. We didn't have a chance to talk on the phone that day, and so I just had been praying in the car on the way home that we'd be able to talk about this, because whatever it was that she said that had really stuck with me that day, it had just been grating on me. And it's like, you know, I just want to say, hey, you know, why'd you say that to me before I left? So I get in, and I come in the kitchen door and put my briefcase down, and Lauren comes around the corner and she's crying. She'd just gotten the phone with her mother. Her father has had Parkinson's disease for a long now, 26 years. Then it was maybe 19 or 20. And he had, there'd just been a development at the doctor. He was not having a great time, and she was just broken about her dad's situation. She's crying, and she's telling me this. And we sit down at the kitchen table. And I said, you know, let's not talk about that right now. What I want to talk about is that sinful thing that you said to me this morning. I didn't really say that. I didn't really do it. I'm kidding. I did not do that. And the reason I did not do that is a reason you do not need me to explain, because you're laughing. All right? So you knew before I started to, I was like, oh my goodness, people are like getting up and leaving. The reason I didn't do it is because of this setting of silver idea. Not everything that needs to be said right now. This is the strategic nature of dealing with sin and suffering. As soon as you say, hey, not everything that needs to be said right now. Do you realize how easier your life just got? You can be committed to saying everything that needs to be said, but you don't have to say it all right now. You can say some of it later. And so this encourages us to think strategically. It's actually small-mindedness and a lack of strategic thinking that assumes that if you're doing something wrong, I have to tell you right now. I have to say it right this minute. And it misses Proverbs 25:11. Keep that apple of gold, but put it in a setting of silver. And if you do that, if people sense that, hey, this person was with me. So Lauren, you know, we did talk at the table for a long time about what was going on with her dad. We prayed together and we cried together. And then like later, like the next morning, I said, hey, what was going on yesterday when you said that? And she's like, oh, I was being stupid. I'm sorry. Will you please forgive me? Now, that would not have happened if I had said, while she's crying about her dad, hey, you know, your dad's important and all, but, you know. So when we do Proverbs 25:11, it will reap dividends in our counseling, because people will appreciate that we are wise, which is what Proverbs 25:11 is about. It's about wisdom, is strategic wisdom that doesn't just vomit out all the words you're thinking of right at this particular moment. Now, there are some exceptions to that general rule. I think we want to err on the side of let's deal with suffering before we deal with sin. But what about some exceptions to the general rule? One exception is that if a counselee is not yet suffering in his sin, you must engage them as a sinner. So the person who doesn't feel broken, the person who's just sinning with a high hand and they don't care what you think and they don't care what their wife thinks, or they don't care what their husband thinks, or they don't care what their family thinks, that person, we're not talking about encouraging that person, because they are not faint-hearted. So the absence of faint-heartedness takes away the call to encourage. We're dealing with somebody who is unruly, who's undisciplined, and so we're admonishing. And so we bring conviction until there's brokenness, and then when there's brokenness, or if there's brokenness, that's when we bring comfort and encouragement. If a counselee is in danger of harming himself or others, if we're talking about someone who could do real damage to themselves, someone who is suicidal or who is homicidal, we might want to take a lot of time to show care to them, and we might not have that option because our commitment to preserve life is going to be, quite frankly, higher than any sort of strategic vision we have about winning their trust or something like that. We're going to need to take action. We're going to need to perhaps call the police, and they might think we're being jerks and insensitive. We might need to call an ambulance. All kinds of things we might need to do, but we'd have to treat that emergency as an emergency. And then also, potentially, if a counselee is engaging in illegal activity, reporting laws in your state or in your area are going to determine this, but it might not even boil down to what reporting laws are. It might boil down to, if this person is doing something dangerous that could harm them, and I might not have to report, but I still need to report because they're in danger. I'll be talking about this later, we could think about an abused wife. You might have an abused wife who is pleading with you not to say anything, but you don't have the freedom to just indulge that request because she's in real danger. How much time we spend engaging the suffering will vary case by case. a short time with the husband heartbroken over ending his adulterous relationship. That guy that I told you about, he's crying in my office. His wife's crying in my office. I love my wife. I love my girlfriend. I can't break up with her. And do you know what I said to him? I said something like, you know what? I understand. I get that it's painful. I know what it is to love things God hates. And I'm so sorry. I know this is hard. But you have to break up with her. And I helped him get out his cell phone and call her and break up with her in the office. And it was a mess and all kinds of for all kinds of reasons that you might expect. So I identified with him in his suffering. He got 40 seconds. I get it. It's hard. And that 40 seconds is what he needed. He didn't need anything. We didn't need to say, I told that story in another context one time and emphasized that I had him pick up a cell phone to break up with the girl, and this one dude raises his hand. He said, that is not biblical counseling. And I said, okay, what's not biblical counseling about? He said, we counsel from the heart, and you did behavior modification. And I said, well, that's true, honestly. It's true, but what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to say, okay, you keep committing adultery, you keep sleeping around, let's have your wife keep crying, and when you're ready, that's when we're going to quit. Like, that's not biblical counseling either. Sometimes we say, here is what you have to do, and counseling is getting your heart caught up. We would not say that just because you broke up with the girl, they're good now. We would say, we got months of counseling to get your heart following behind where your behavior is. But we don't say, just keep doing this, keep introducing the risk of STDs into your marriage, keep introducing the risk of illegitimate children into your marriage. Let's just keep doing all that, keep your wife crying, and that's counseling the heart. That's not counseling the heart. That's counseling feelings. There's something really different. So a short time with a husband heartbroken over ending his adulterous relationship, and a longer time with a wife who was struggling with sorrow over the adultery. You don't say to that woman 5 seconds after he confesses his sin that, you know, now you have to forgive. When she is struggling with the pain, when she comes back the next week and she's crying because she wants to forgive him but she doesn't know how to forgive him, we say that this woman's on the journey here. We say she's doing what she's supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be angry and sad when your husband commits adultery because God is angry and sad when your husband commits adultery. And so we're not pressing for the fullness of the feelings of forgiveness. We've got time to allow this to take root. Now, by the time you got skillets involved, now we're talking about a rebuke. But we've got patience for this woman who's the victim of someone else's sin and who is trying to get in a better spot. What about moving from suffering to sin? Well, if we're going to start with suffering, how do we get to sin? Well, I say three things: listen, share, and teach. First of all, listen to the counselee's struggle. Do you know how many people will trust you and care about anything you have to say just because you listen to them? I've had people start crying in counseling after I had one woman, she talked about her husband's abuse for 2 hours. And she finished, and I said, I cannot imagine how painful that must be. And she started sobbing. That's it. I just made that statement. And she said through sobs that no one had ever listened to her before. Nobody. If you listen to people, they will care about what you have to say much of the time. And then share. Share your own story of pain. It doesn't have to be the same exact story of pain. They might be abused, and you might have gone through the loss of a child. But the contours of pain and suffering would still be there. Now, the one thing you want to do is you don't want to compare your slight suffering with great suffering. You don't want to say to somebody who lost their child, and then you tell your story about being late for an appointment one day. That communicates a minimization of their struggle. But you can share your own story of pain and what the Lord taught you in the midst of that pain. Or you could share truths from Scripture. The Bible is always honest about the pain and the suffering we experience, but it always points that suffering towards Christ and His salvation. And then teach. Teach the truth of God's message and a call to repentance. So you can say, you know, I've been abused too, if you have. And it's very painful. But here's what the Lord taught me in that, when I did that. that, or here's what God says to David in Psalm 50 that causes him to round the corner in the pain. And that's something that you could do too. That's something that you're not doing, and it's something that Jesus could help you do. Do you know what that's called? That's called a rebuke. But it doesn't feel like a rebuke. I'm wearing contact lenses. We're out of time. I'm landing the plane. I'm wearing contact lenses, and I've never had to wear glasses until about 2 years ago. And I had to wear them when I was reading, but I could make do without them. And then by the time I finished this one book, I couldn't do anything anymore. The contact lenses they gave me didn't work, so I had to start wearing glasses. And I hated wearing these glasses. Oh, my goodness, I hated wearing the stupid glasses. And I wasn't used to having something hanging off my face. I was used to seeing life without lenses, and so there'd be streaks on them that would just bug me, and I was obsessing over keeping them completely clean. And about that time, I was speaking at a conference in New York, and the pastor who was hosting me and his wife, dear sweet couple, and this was the first week of me having the glasses, and I was complaining about these stupid glasses all the time. Glasses, and I would try to take them off and try to get through a meal without the glasses on. And she said to me one night at dinner when I was whining about the glasses and I'd taken them off and was trying to, like, see, she said, "Do you know, I used to be the same way." She wore glasses. She said, "I used to be the same way, and I hated them too. And then I just realized, you know, we live in a fallen world where I need glasses. And God is so kind to give me the glasses as a gift. And I think I probably ought to stop complaining about them." And it just really helped me. And I'm like, I think she just rebuked me. And she did. But it's the best rebuke is the kind of rebuke where you feel like somebody's with you in it and they're not like, "Sinner." But they're just pointing you to what the Lord has shown them from the scriptures. And if we can do that, then we'll be the kinds of counselors that can help people. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we're grateful for the fact that you reveal to us in the Word that we are sinners and that we are sufferers, and we're grateful for the wisdom that you give to us about how to engage those realities. Help us to grow in our wisdom to minister to broken people, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.